You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We often end each year with a look back at the year that was, but at The Economist, the tradition has been to look ahead to the year to come. Each December, the magazine publishes predictions for the next 12 months, and joining me now to reveal what The Economist has predicted in its The World in 2009 issue is Daniel Franklin, the editor of the annual series. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hello, Daniel.
Hello. Good to be with you again.
And before we look at 2009, I wanted to rehash some of the predictions for 2008 we discussed on the show last December. The Economist predicted that the American economy could end 2008 without a recession and that Hillary Clinton would win the presidency. There were also misses on oil prices and the Russian military. Was that why you decided to write an apology in this year's edition?
Well, every year we like to look back and look at what we said a year ago and see what we got right and what we got wrong. I think it's only fair to our readers to do that. And, of course, we get a fair amount wrong every year. Perhaps this year we got more than usual wrong, because particularly the extreme events that happened in the economy. We got some things right as well, but I think it's in the nature of the predictions game that you aren't going to get everything right, and it's good to remind people as well that this is the best guess at the time.
What were the main things you got right?
Well, of course, we knew it was going to be a difficult year with the economy, so we did predict the measures that would be taken to try and keep, for example, the American economy going, the fiscal stimulus, the deep cuts in interest rates, the dollar going down at least in the first half of the year and stimulating exports. All those things happen. Beyond America, we predicted the crash of the Shanghai Stock Exchange and stock market, and the troubles that the British economy in particular would have because of its reliance on the city and the financial services industry.
In every issue, you end with an obituary from Ann Rowe, and this one's no exception. This one is devoted to the Bush administration, and she's saying that George Bush's nostrils will be missed.
Well, she has a habit of sort of picking up on the essence of the individual that she's writing an obituary on in the regular Economist, and she picks up in this case on the Bush administration. Obviously, it's a bit unusual to write an obituary for the year ahead, so we try and find something that we know is going to expire in the coming year, obviously not an individual, but in this case, the administration. Last year, if you remember, it was Yankee Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, she picks up on the, I think, the Bush instinct is symbolized as she picks on the nostrils, and she makes her piece out of that.
Well, she says that if we watch the nostrils, we can learn an awful lot about what he's really thinking. How do the writers and the editors of The Economist arrive at their prediction? Is the idea to be as accurate as possible, or is this more an exercise in educated guesswork?
I think a bit of both. I mean, you obviously have an element of educated guesswork, but on the basis of knowledge and as the facts that you can muster. So you try to look at all the evidence that there is out there, and then I think in this particular volume, the idea is to stick your neck out a bit further than you would normally do, and with the aim of making a prediction as firmly as possible. And, of course, sometimes that's going to be right, and sometimes it's going to end up being embarrassing.
Well, among the contributors to this year's edition are Spanish Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, Queen Rania of Jordan, Brazilian President Lula da Silva. Are politicians good at predicting the future?
Well, not always, of course, but they're quite good at telling you what's on their agenda, and I think that can be revealing in itself. So, you know, if you have a politician such as Lula in Brazil, you glean from his piece that high on his agenda is a bigger say for Brazil and other big emerging economies in the governance of the world. So you get a sense of how Brazil is going to push that agenda in the year ahead and indeed in the future. So I think that's helpful. And in the case of Queen Rania, for example, of Jordan, you get the sense of the importance of education to that country with a very, very young fast-growing young population coming through, and indeed in the wider Arab world, that's going to be a key issue.
Well, Lula, of course, is the president of a huge country, but the Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd, contributed a piece about the role of medium-sized powers in global issues. Will they play a key role in matters like climate change, and can they play much of a role in something like this financial crisis?
Well, there again, I think you do get a sense through his piece of how different countries have different parts to play, and Australia, of course, recognizes it's not a major power, but its voice can be heard in concert with others, and you have the sense of the ways in which a country such as Australia, which has actually been a very successful country in recent years with an extraordinary growth record, how it will try to pursue issues such as environmental policy and security policy in the region, and it recognizes it has to do that by teaming up with other countries through other groupings.
Well, they're all suggesting that that the former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger is onto something when he writes of a new world order starting to take place. But wasn't he one of the major architects of the old world order that he's predicting will be replaced?
Well, I guess if you're a policy maker or a policy commentator, you, as the world changes, you have to adapt to it. And there is, I think, a recognition. In fact, that's one of the main things I think emerges from many of the contributions to this volume, that there is a shift taking place in the world, perhaps a with 20 years now after the fall of the Berlin Wall. One of the other things we write about, we're beginning to see some of the settling down of the new world order, where a number of countries are starting to feel that it's not just going to be a single superpower, that there is a need and indeed a demand by many players in the world to have a say, increasingly particularly as the economic power swings more towards the big emerging economies of Asia, for example, and how that new global order comes into place is one of, I think, the big challenges facing the Obama administration.
Well, so people are predicting a diminished role for the United States. At the same time, everybody seems to be putting an awful lot of hope on Barack Obama. In fact, some are saying that high expectations are among the major problems that he faces.
I think that's right, and it's not necessarily, America is condemned, I think, to face this dilemma of being the country everybody looks to solve the world's problems, but at the same time a country that many want to see diminish its overwhelming influence. I think there's no question that America will remain the single most important and powerful country in the world for a long time to come. But at the same time, that power has to be exercised subtly and carefully and in consultation often with other powers that are increasingly demanding a say. It was interesting, I think, to see recently you had the group of 20 countries gathering in Washington to look at the global economic situation, and I think you had a sense there of a wider grouping coming to the fore where you need to bring in some of these other countries beyond the rich world G7, beyond the UN Permanent Five, to try to grapple with issues that are truly global.
My guest is Daniel Franklin, editor of The World in 2009, The Economist's annual issue in which they predict what's coming up. And the United States has gotten involved in trying to resolve the problems in the Middle East, which is, of course, the story that's been dominating the headlines this week. And many people say that the United States no longer will have much clout.
Well, the U.S. will, of course, have clout. It will have clout in anywhere it chooses to become engaged in the world. I think the challenge, particularly for the incoming Obama administration, is to decide how and where it chooses to exercise that great influence it has. And that goes, I think, in particular for the Middle East. How much political capital does the new administration decide to spend in the Middle East, a particularly complex, difficult place where the risk of failure is very high, but the certainty of failure, if you don't get involved early on, is also is also there. So,
but haven't we seen a series of failures? Bill Clinton put an awful lot of political capital into his attempts to arrive at some kind of a peace agreement, and that failed. As recently as October, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was promising to pursue a peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. We see that's not happening. But should we, is it more complicated than just getting some peace going? For example, should we differentiate between words like Palestinians and Hamas?
Yes, I think, I would just to return to what you said, I think the Clinton administration had a mixed record. Of course, it did have the famous reconciliation early on between Israel and the Palestinians with Arafat and Rabin on the White House lawn, but then left it very late to try to do the Camp David agreement, and there was a sort of last-ditch attempt at the end of the presidency. And indeed, that's one of the criticisms of the Bush administration, that it left it rather late to get seriously engaged in this area. So there will be those advising President-elect Obama that he should get involved early in this issue. But of course, as you point out, it's one where the risk of failure is very great.
Well, are Israeli parliamentary elections making matters even more complicated? Benjamin Netanyahu is likely to win the next election, and he has been rather hawkish. But could there be another kind of surprise, like when Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat arrived at a peace treaty, two very unlikely men to arrive at one? Does it take somebody like Netanyahu or Richard Nixon to go to China rather than somebody more liberal?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Of course, you're right to say that the elections are a complicating factor at the moment, and of course the motivation for these current operations in Gaza, you are being interpreted as at least in part influenced by electoral considerations, and the political situation in general in Israel is a very messy one, very unclear actually who will emerge victorious. It's an extremely complex political system in Israel with lots of parties and coalition building. But I think it is possible for there to be a surprise, particularly, though, with the help of American pressure. I don't think it could come without American pressure of some sort of push for peace, whoever emerges as the new Prime Minister of Israel.
We're talking with Daniel Franklin about the world in 2009. The Economist puts out an issue every year which predicts what's going to happen in the future. Sometimes they get things right, sometimes they don't, but it's always interesting to compare the predictions with what actually happened and also to think about why these predictions have been made. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Daniel Franklin, editor of The World in 2009 from The Economist, which features articles from Jeff Immelt, Henry Kissinger, Paul Allen on mapping the brain, Joseph Ackerman on curing finance. Let's talk a bit about finance and whether it can be cured. What will happen with the global economy in 2009? Will we see any improvements, by this time next year?
Well, by this time next year, I think possibly, but in the first half of the year, certainly, I think it's going to be very, very tough. I think it's almost inevitable we're going to see big rises in unemployment, not only in America, but also in Europe, and in my own country, Britain, certainly. That's a clear and rising trend and a very distressing one, I think, for the world. Even, I think, and this is the to make matters just a little bit worse, in some of the emerging economies which have been growing so quickly in recent years, China, India, they're experiencing troubles too, and concerned that the growth rate there, although we'll still see growth there, will slip beneath what is needed to absorb the very rapid numbers of people coming into the labor market.
Do you think that the financial crisis in Russia will have an effect on the popularity of Vladimir Putin?
Yes, I think it will. I think it'll be a tougher year for Putin and Medvedev, the president, as well. C- compared with recent years, where Russia really has been growing very rapidly, thanks to its oil and other raw materials, which where the prices have been rising very fast. Now the prices are down. They're going to have budget problems. You've already seen stock market problems there, and a big decline in the ruble. So it won't, I think, translate into a rebellion, shall we say, against Putin, but I think it'll be tougher waters for him to navigate. I would expect that they will see some opportunities there for getting control of yet more assets that may fall into difficulties, particularly some of the raw material producers that were privatized, made some people very rich, and now the state can use the troubles that some of those companies will be in to perhaps grab a bigger share of the economy back for the state.
Well, we're going to see variations on that all throughout the world, aren't we? In recent years, as globalization has had more proponents than critics, we have seen a cutback on regulations. Now governments are talking about putting more financial regulations in place. What kind of mechanisms do you think we'll see in 2009?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. We'll certainly see more regulation. And, of course, we're already seeing a big increase of the state's share of the economy, even in countries that don't particularly want to have a bigger share of the economy but are being sucked in by the economic troubles and the crisis in the financial system. I think the big question there is how quickly will the state feel able or in some cases willing to extricate itself, having got in there in the first place? Will it get out as fast as possible?
Well, we're seeing the Bush administration doing something that in the past would have been called socialism.
Exactly that. Big grabs, if you like, for leading areas of the economy. And again, as I say, this is not where either the Bush administration or I expect the Obama administration particularly wants to be, but how quickly will it be able to divest some of the interests that it has? As for regulation, you mentioned banking regulation. The big question there is, I think, whether it will be effective regulation or not, because the regulators typically are regulating for the problems of the past crisis and potentially put in regulation with unintended consequences that sometimes leads to the next batch of problems.
In this country, we have just experienced what many are calling the worst retail holiday season in memory. Any number of major retailers are declaring bankruptcy, and Americans are obviously not spending their money. Will that prolong the recession, or is that necessary because Americans have saved so little in recent years?
Well, you're right that America will have to save more, and that will be one of the things we'll see in the coming year, a continued increase in savings by Americans. But how quickly, how sharply it turns around from really zero or negative savings to a more traditional and sustainable level of savings, that's the issue. And I think the problems of the retail industry, not just in America, by the way, but also elsewhere, will be one of the things that will translate into job losses and some of the more famous names, but this time in the corporate sector, going under.
There are a lot of elections that will be taking place all over the world in 2009. South Africa in April, India's People's Assembly must be elected by May, Indonesia's president in July, Chile and Mozambique in December. Iraq will hold elections for the Council of Representatives in December. Which of these do you think will have the biggest impact?
Well, as you say, it is a big political year. India, I would think, is a particular one to watch. It is the world's most populous democracy. It's always, whenever it holds an election, more than a billion people in that country, of course, it's always slightly nerve-jangling. How well will it go off, particularly now in the wake of the bombings in Mumbai? Tensions there could be quite high, so that will certainly be one to watch. I think also in Europe, we have elections across Europe in June for the European Parliament, so that's 500 million people in the European Union. And Germany, Europe's biggest economy, most important pivotal country in Europe. Germany has a general election in September.
Do you think Angela Merkel will have a tough re-election campaign?
Yes, my hunch is that she'll get back, but it's this very odd situation where she has what's called a grand coalition of her Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats. So she is locked together in government with her main opponent for this election. And you have some of the smaller parties, the Greens, the Free Democrats, and something called the Left Party, which has been on the rise. So I think we'll see perhaps some complex coalition forming there in the wake of that election.
Do you think Russia will continue to distance itself from the West?
Well, Russia, I think, will both find it in its interest to be assertive in the way that it has been, as we saw in the war over Georgia and its response to the independence declaration of Kosovo, for example, and some of its oil diplomacy. But at the same time, I think part of the lesson of this economic difficulties it's been through is its interdependence with the West. It needs the West. It cannot isolate itself from developments in the West. So I think there will be a prickly relationship with Russia, but every interest in actually cooperating in certain areas where Russia needs to.
People have been predicting for a long time democratization in China, but 2009 marks the 20th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. So, do you think there'll be any renewed push for rights in China?
Well, I think it's one of the very sensitive political anniversaries that there are in the year ahead, and certainly China is going to face a problem if its economy does wobble in a serious way as a result of the economic difficulties elsewhere. We've seen that the export-led growth that it's experienced in spectacular fashion in recent years is going to be in trouble, particularly because of recession in America and elsewhere. So it has to try to get growth by other means, and it has money to spend. It will throw money, I'm sure, and investment at the problem. But the implicit bargain in China, whereby they don't have democracy, they don't have a high degree of political freedom, but in return, the regime delivers spectacular growth and much improved living standards for many people, that is in danger of fraying, and we already see a rise in some forms of protest there. They are, I think, worried about the prospect of social unrest in China.
There's the whole matter of climate change as well. At the end of 2009, there'll be a summit in Copenhagen that will try to reach a post-Kyoto agreement on greenhouse emission reductions. When the first agreement was reached, Bill Clinton faced a Congress that was opposed to voting it in. Do you think that Congress will be more amenable under Barack Obama, considering changed attitudes about global warming over the last 10 or 15 years?
Well, certainly the mood has changed, as you say, and I think America's attitude to climate change under the Bush administration, in the early days of the Bush administration in particular, was one of the things that caused it most problems and most difficulties in terms of opinion outside America. And that is something that I think Barack Obama certainly wants to change, and he talks very differently about it than the previous administration. In Congress, political leaders certainly talk about wanting to introduce much stronger legislation on climate change, but it's going to be a very, very tough negotiation with strong national interests at stake in Copenhagen in a year's time, and I think it'll actually be quite hard to reach a meaningful agreement there to, if you like, reconcile the very diverse interests of countries like the United States, China, India wanting to develop very rapidly, and the Europeans.
One of the most controversial predictions, as far as I'm concerned, in the World in 2000 Economist issue is your prediction, or somebody's prediction, that Blu-ray disc sales will jump. Why do you think that'll happen now? There's been so much resistance, especially now that the economy is tight. Why would people want to do that?
Well, I think that there is resistance partly because of the price of Blu-ray discs, and to some extent the price of the the recorders to watch them on. But I guess it's the maturity of the technology. People are starting to expect high definition and take that quality as more something that they expect to see. So maybe it's time for those to make the leap, if you like.
There's also a piece in this year's edition about how sharing on sites like Facebook, MySpace, Flickr, and YouTube are taking on a life of their own. What will that mean for the year to come? And is it becoming harder to manage the information that's out there on the Internet for anyone to see?
I think it is. I think it's a new culture. I think it's clear that this is an absolutely enormous trend that is here to stay, and more people, not only young people, are doing it. But the issue is, though, of course, that it's perhaps a threat to people's privacy. This article argues that it's our own threat to our own privacy by putting so much out there and by allowing our friends to put so much out there, perhaps sometimes unthinkingly, too trustingly. Then we may put our own reputations and privacy at risk. So perhaps in the year ahead, people will start to learn to be a bit more mindful of, a bit more careful of how they, what information they put out about themselves and about other people.
It is interesting that the Internet we tend to think of as being the playground mostly of the young, but the median age of the 7 biggest and richest democracies will pass 40 this year. That means we have a lot of aging population for the world's richest countries. What is the implication of that? How will they cope with shrinking labor forces?
Well, there are well-known implications, of course, for the labor force and for supporting increasing the aging population through retirement, and that's going to place increasing pressure over the years. Of course, it's not something that happens overnight from one year to the next. These are trends that happen over time, slowly, but nevertheless, the burden on the younger generation will become greater. And in some parts of the world, the pressures, for example, to encourage or have more liberal policies on immigration in order to bring in people who can do services for an aging population, that will grow.
There are already a lot of plans for 2009. Ireland will start to phase out the sale of incandescent light bulbs. The United States government expects to close Guantanamo Bay. China will open the world's largest Ferris wheel. But the one that struck me was that Libya is said to be planning to abolish most of its government ministries so that the people can run the country. How can that possibly work? And does that mean that Muammar Gaddafi is going to eliminate his own job?
I think that's highly unlikely. I think it's a sort of populist measure to give the impression, at least, of popular democracy.
Whereas Gaddafi actually can consolidate more power as a
result. I would imagine that's more likely.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us again, and we'll see how many of these predictions pan out in the next year. When we talk to you next year, maybe we'll even talk sometime during the year.
Thank you. I'd like that. Thank you.
Daniel Franklin is the editor of The World in 2009, published annually by The Economist magazine. Thank you so much.